Good evening, everyone. We're going to begin. In many ways, tonight takes us back to darker times of history. But at the same time, coming off the joy and the celebration of Yom HaAtzmaut, I believe that studying this part of history, and we are trying to go in order here, it wasn't exactly planned that the same week of Yom HaAtzmaut we should look at writings from the Holocaust. But it is the case that we understand the juxtaposition of the days on our calendar marking Holocaust Memorial Day, days where we remember tragic events in our history, just before we mark great moments in our history. And not that we're here to debate whether there would have been a state of Israel, there wouldn't have been a state of Israel, had these events occurred, not occurred, but we're here to kind of affirm our necessity on one level of having a place for Jews to be able to go in the event that, looking at this event of history. So we will dedicate our study tonight to the Kedoshim, to those who perished during the Shoah, family members, and to that time. So we'll start, and we're going to break this up into three parts. We're going to look at writings from before the war, and those will look at how rabbinic leaders, community leaders, spoke to their communities about what was going on, whether they should leave, whether they shouldn't leave, whether they themselves, their decisions to go or not to go, issues of how Jews outside of Europe were looking in and how they were looking on to this storm that was starting to get darker and darker as the years passed in the 1930s. Then we'll look at some writings that we have, that we know were written during the Shoah in various places, under various circumstances. And then at the end, we'll look at how some of the post-Holocaust thinkers reflect back and try to understand how it is we can understand or not understand or try to understand, justify or not justify these events. So we'll begin with an article that was written in, a Jewish newspaper on April the 4th, 1933. And it's titled, "Wear It With Pride, the Yellow Badge." This apparently was the day, or around the time of the enactment, where Jews were told that they had to wear a yellow demarcation, a yellow star, a yellow badge. And what's interesting about this piece is that it kind of flips the whole idea on its head. And it looks at the idea of a yellow star as something that Jews should be looking to with a sense of pride. So here is his comment. Source number one: "We live in a new period. The national revolution of the German people is a signal that is visible from afar, indicating that the world of our previous concepts has collapsed." Remember that Hitler came to power in January of the same year. So April 1st, 1933 can become the day of Jewish awakening and Jewish rebirth. And you hear these words, you kind of wonder to yourself, maybe scratch your head and say, how can anybody say that when we look back in history and know what happened after that? If the Jews will it, if the Jews are mature and have greatness in them, if the Jews are not as they are represented to be by their opponents, the Jews under attack must learn to acknowledge themselves, because the Jew did not display his Judaism with pride. Because he tried to avoid the Jewish issue, he must bear part of the blame for the degradation of the Jews. And here, he's touching on something that I think we've spent a lot of time thinking about and a lot of time developing throughout our weeks studying these different points in history. And that's the tension of how we live in a country that is ruled by non-Jewish leaders, by sometimes Christian leaders, sometimes Muslim leaders, and the Jewish interaction or the Jewish experience in those countries was one of a lot of gray, a lot of trying to figure out where we fit in, how much we should fit in, how much we shouldn't fit in. And in Germany, which in many ways was the highlighted place of assimilation, emancipation, enlightenment, Jews really trying to become part and parcel of the society, this was a place where Jews did their best to try to hide their identity, to try to remove their identity. And now, as of this time, in 1933, the Jew is marked as a Jew. He gets the yellow badge. So he writes, we will take it up and make of it a badge of honor. Just hear those words and think about what that message is. We're going to wear the yellow star as a badge of honor. Who would have ever gave that as a title to such a demarcation? In addition to other signs and inscriptions, one often saw windows bearing a large Magen David, the shield of David the king. It was intended as dishonor. Jews, take it up, the shield of David, and wear it with pride. So you hear these words, and whether this was something that a lot of people agreed with, or a lot of people felt was something that we should identify with, certainly gives off a certain sentiment, which is, we're going to try to make this work. We're going to try to do our best under the circumstances, and not just our best, but actually try to figure out a way to see this as a good sign, which in so many ways gives us a very hard time to actually connect to these words as we look at them in the year 2017. It was written in German, I believe, and then translated later on. So, in the bottom half of the page, there's a few excerpts from a letter to Hitler himself, written by the Jewish community in 1933, the Orthodox community. I don't have the signees, but there was a group of signees on this letter. And they're writing mid-1933. And here are just a few excerpts from what they said. And in this letter, it's more ambivalent. It's not necessarily a feeling of we think everything is rosy, or we're trying to turn a bad situation into a good situation. It was more about, here is what we know is happening on the ground, and we would like to understand better what it is that are the intentions of the government. So a few examples. If you look on the left side. The undersigned, the Most Respectful Free Association for the Interests of Orthodox Jewry, has the honor, also on behalf of the two co-signatory organizations, to submit a memorandum on the German-Jewish question in the hope that it may receive favorable consideration. So they, using this term of the Jewish question, which we've spoken about before. The undersigned Orthodox Jewish organizations representing the section of German Jewry, which considers Jewish religion as the sole ground justification of the historical existence of the Jewish people. And he goes on in that paragraph to talk about how we're here, we're Jewish, we're Orthodox, and we're also German citizens. And then he starts to talk about what they've seen starting to happen. German National Socialist Party claims that the Jewish race is pernicious and inferior. We would be going too far were we to question the evidence and results of scientific race theory. There's just one thing we would be so bold as to assert. The Jewish people are no unknown strangers to Germans, even in the intellectual field. Jewish Bible, books of the New Testament, conceived and written by Jews, have been impressing indelible traces in the German essence for 1,000 years, have shaped and determined it from within. Who is to say whether the Psalms of David and the exalted morality of the Jewish prophets have a larger or smaller share in the soul that German people, German artists, and German spiritual leaders have inherited from humble and pious mothers and fathers than the Nordic blood of the Vikings and the heritage of German heroes? Strong words. The influence of German Jewry on the German nation, not just Jewish history in that country, but history in that country. Yet the call for liberation from alien Jewish influences is being applied even to the Bible by some individuals in the National Socialist camp. If you look in the right column, as is the present situation, German Jewry is created for them by the German people, completely intolerable one. In respect of their legal position and also of their economic existence, their good name, and their scope for religious activity. So he goes on, he talks about what's been going on, the boycotts, the quotas, all of these things that we've learned about and we've heard about. And then, if you look down near the end of the letter, the defamation of the Jews, and then in the last two paragraphs, they say this: Orthodox Jewry has no wish to abandon its conviction that the German government, remember it's 1933, does not seek the destruction of German Jewry. So they didn't believe that this was part of the plan in 1933. Even if some individuals do have this objective, we do not believe that it meets the approval of the Führer or the German government. But if we are wrong, basically, let us know so we can get out of town. So it's this letter was printed in a book called Between the Yeshiva and Modern Orthodoxy. It's a book about the life of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who survived, escaped, and later wrote the responsa Sridei Esh, which has a lot of very interesting topics in it. And he was asked a question at this time. There was a big issue in Germany, in Berlin, among some of the major halachic questions that we're going to look at this evening. There was an issue with Shechita. The government had basically banned the traditional Shechita practices, in a way. And what happened was, they said it was cruel, it was cruelty. So they outlawed it, unless the animal had been previously stunned by an electric shock. So the pre-stunning of the animal raised this question, since it could, you know, cause lesions, that the electric shock could cause lesions in the animal, which would render the animal a terefa, which basically means it's unfit for kosher use. So even if it were slaughtered properly after that. So this is going on in these early years. They come to Rabbi Weinberg, where this letter is printed in the back of the book about his life. And he's the head of the yeshiva, the Beit Midrash L'Rabbanim in Berlin. Everybody is writing him questions from all over Europe. And he finds some warrant for permitting the shechita of these electrically stunned animals, particularly under these difficult conditions, and especially for those who are ill-aged or infirm. It goes on. But these are some things that people were starting to think about and talk about, and we don't know exactly what was in the works in 1933. We don't know exactly what was being planned. But the signs weren't wonderful, the signs weren't great, and you can hear how the Jewish community was grappling with some of these new policies, these new issues, trying to wrap their heads around it. In source number two, I guess the numbers are off here. In source number two, it should really be number three, but we'll call it number two. On the second page, 2B, I have an excerpt here from a sermon that was given by Rav Kook. We spent a lot of time last week studying the life of Rav Kook. Rav Kook died in 1935, before the war, but he was living in the 1930s during this time. And he delivered a sermon in the old city of Jerusalem on Rosh Hashanah. And he actually chose to do it specifically in Yerushalayim, in a shul that many people here have probably visited before, the Churva Shul, formerly known as the Ramban Shul, or still called the Ramban Shul. It's right in the middle of the square, of the Rova Square, in the middle of the Jewish quarter in Jerusalem. And he wanted to address what was happening in the world, what was happening in Europe. So he decided to go to this particular synagogue and give a speech. And he spoke about a concept within the laws of shofar. And you have it here in source 2. We say in our daily prayers, sound the great shofar for our freedom. Right? Shofar gadol. Tikuba shofar gadol. Raise the banner to bring our exiles together. So he talks about three types of shofars that are all permitted to be used for the commandment, for the mitzvah, to hear the shofar blast on Rosh Hashanah. The optimal shofar is the horn of a ram. If a ram's horn is not available, then the horn of any kosher animal other than a cow may be used. And if a kosher shofar is not available, then one may blow on the horn of any animal, even one which is not kosher. So you have ideal, a little bit under the ideal, and then you have the less ideal. When using a horn from a non-kosher animal, however, no blessing is recited. But you would still fulfill the mitzvah of tikiyat shofar on Rosh Hashanah. These three shofars of Rosh Hashanah correspond to the three shofars of redemption. Each shofar bringing the Jewish people closer, the message bringing the Jewish people closer to that day, to be redeemed and to redeem their land. And he goes through each of them. The most ideal one, then the second level, and then the third level. And he writes about the third one there, smack in the middle of the paragraph. And he bursts out in tears. This is how it was reported when he talks about the third shofar. He says, the least desirable shofar comes from the horn of an unclean animal. This shofar corresponds to the wake-up call that comes from the persecutions of anti-Semitic nations, warning the Jews to escape while they still can and flee to their own land. Enemies force the Jewish people to be redeemed, to blasting the trumpets of war, bombarding them with deafening threats of harassment and torment, giving them no respite. The shofar of unclean beasts is thus transformed into a shofar of redemption. It's frightening words, because what's Rav Kook speaking about? He's talking about what's going on at that time in Germany. And he's saying that by choice or by force, the Jews are going to leave, or they're not going to be able to leave. And whoever failed to hear the calls of the first two shofars, meaning all the Jews who we spoke about last week, who went on the Aliyot, who came to Israel in the previous 40 years of history before the 1930s, will be forced to listen to the call of this last shofar. Over this shofar, however, no blessing is recited. And this was a sermon that he gave same year, 1933. Those words were heard, not necessarily answered by everybody, but shook a lot of communities when these words got out. There is a rabbi, one of the few, who actually switched from being in the anti-Zionist camp to becoming a Zionist. And the reason why he became a Zionist is Hitler, the war. And he wrote a book called Eim HaBanim Smecha. His name was Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal. And this book basically argues for a religious perspective on Zionism. And as I mentioned, he grew up, he was born in Hungary. He was from a family, a rabbinic family, a chassid of the Rebbe of Tzanz. So he comes from this very anti-Zionist upbringing. And as a result of the things that were happening in Europe, he changed his position on Israel, because he was struggling to make sense of what was happening around him. So this book was written in 1943, in the middle of when everything was going on. He was in a hiding, he had a whole situation, he ended up not surviving. The end of his life is very tragic. But his book was preserved, his book was kept. And he writes here in different parts of his book, he talks about people that made the move to go to Israel. And he talks about how the Orthodox community is to blame. And he gives a certain kind of guilt that he lays on the community and the leadership. He quotes this Gemara, Masechet Avodah Zarah, whoever prepares prior to Shabbat will eat on Shabbat. And he uses that as a metaphor to describe those who took action to make it their business to get out of Europe. Since the Orthodox did not toil, they have absolutely no influence in the land. And he's here making this point that at that time, the people who were really developing the Zionist enterprise in pre-state Palestine were the secular community. Those who toil and build have the influence, and now they are the masters of the land. It's therefore no wonder that they are in control. Now what will the Orthodox say? And he goes on, in the second paragraph, had the God-fearing religious Jews been involved in this undertaking, our holy land would have had a completely different, more sanctified appearance and form than it has now. Who will accept responsibility for the innocent blood that isn't spilled in our days? And he's writing during this time. It seems to me that all the leaders who prevented the people of Israel from joining the builders cannot cleanse their hands and say, our hands did not spill this blood, referencing the parsha of the Egla Arufa, the calf where there's a body that's found in between two cities, and they don't know who the murderer was, and the rabbis of the town have to go out and do this whole ceremony where they basically absolve everyone from the guilt. And they have this line, "Our hands did not spill this blood." And he's using that as a kind of a condemnation of those leaders who prevented their own communities from going. Another comment from not that time, a little bit earlier in history, but probably maybe 20 years, maybe just 25 years before this, the Meshe Chochma wrote in his commentary on the last parsha in Vayikra, which contains the parsha of the Tochacha, the rebukes, the promises that God will make when the Jews break their covenant. And he writes in there on the Tochacha, he has this line, "If the Jew thinks that Berlin is Jerusalem, then a raging storm wind will uproot him by his trunk and subject him before a faraway Gentile nation. A tempest will arise and spread its roaring waves and swallow and destroy and flood forth without pity. Therefore you will not be calm, nor shall there be a resting place, for the sole of your foot is a blessing. For as long as the Jewish people are uncomfortable in exile, they will yearn to return to their homeland. But once they choose to see a different city as their capital, that's when the problems begin." So to flee or to stay, this was the debate that raged in communities throughout Europe, throughout the 1930s. We don't have enough time to go into a lot of the different stories. I just have one excerpt here, one of the examples of this. The previous contention in source 5 had been held 17 years early in Austria. This was already things were happening already in Europe, much earlier on, and community leaders were saying not to go. At a time when a huge cloud of anxiety hung over all of Europe, this is 1937, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, the Rosh Yeshiva of Baranovich, addressed a few hundred distinguished rabbinic personalities and cautioned Torah Jewry against making any major decisions, one way or the other, without first seeking rabbinic guidance regarding how to respond to the looming threat. And Rav Elchanan Wasserman, Hashem Yikom Damo, was captured in July 1941. He was giving a shiur at that moment, and it was a whole story where the Nazis were rounding up rabbinic personalities. A whole list of people were murdered on that day, along with him. There were two rabbis who escaped, Rav Yisrael Yaakov Lubchansky and Rav Ephraim Oshri, who we're going to mention in a few moments, who ended up writing many answers to questions that were asked to him while he spent time in the Kovna ghetto. But he survived, one of the lucky ones. And this question was a question that was dealt with by many. Some of the rabbinic leaders said, "I'm the captain of the ship, and I can't leave. I can't leave my community behind." Some of them told their communities to stay. Some of them used all kinds of different methodologies to try to figure out what to do. And we know of those who left, but the majority did not. The majority did not. So these are some of the issues and challenges that were being looked at by the communities before the war. We're going to look at now, moving into the second part. Go ahead.
Why didn't they leave? Was it a religious thing that Mashiach hadn't come yet?
Part of it was that, to go to Israel. We've already mentioned, and we're going to see at the end here. To go to Israel was trying to bring the Mashiach too early. It was trying to force God's hand in history. Maybe some people said just financially they weren't capable. Some people had an argument that, you know, Palestine can't absorb this number of people. Some people tried to go and they had to go back. It wasn't that. There are many, many, many variations to the story. But en masse, if you look at the stories, and there's been a lot has been written on this, a lot of the cases, it was the community leaders that were telling their followers not to leave. In some cases, they were telling their followers to leave.
But if these were all pre-1939, the Germans yet weren't in these countries, like Hungary.
Right.
They're running from...
That's right.
It's like us sitting in Canada talking about Trump.
So maybe they didn't feel it as much, yeah, for sure. So now we're going to look at some of the writings that we have, that we know about from the years of 1939 to 1945. And this obviously are some of the most difficult things to look at and to read and to try to absorb and to reflect on. The first personality we're going to look at, in many ways a unique type of writing, is the Eish Kodesh of Clonimus Kalman Shapira, who wrote this book, Eish Kodesh. You see it there on the page from source 6. And the Eish Kodesh was in the Warsaw Ghetto. This is where he was for a number of years, until they liquidated the ghetto. And while he was in the ghetto, he tried to help the Jews who were there, to give them strength, to give them some level of optimism, but not false optimism, healthy doses of reality, but at the same time, using the Torah, using the Parsha, using the holidays. So it's a unique book. Everybody here has probably opened up at some point in their life a Dvar Torah, you know, weekly Dvar Torah page that you find in your shul, or a book that you have at home. You're preparing, you know, a Dvar Torah for a simcha, something of that nature. And you open up the weekly Parsha and you find a, you know, a quote from a pasuk, maybe a midrash, maybe a modern day commentary, and you write up a idea. The Eish Kodesh was writing out of a context of horrific circumstances. And he was using what was going on in his life and in his surroundings to inform his Torah knowledge, but also to use that as a springboard to help the people in the community. So I just brought two examples here in the first top and bottom of source 6. One from 1940 and one from 1942. And a lot of people who've studied his work, the Eish Kodesh, it's not a very long book. It's 3 years, but it's not every single week. They don't have parshas from the whole year. So it's selections from different parshiot. And these were written down, and they were buried in the Warsaw Ghetto, and they were found after. They were buried in canisters, and they were found after the war. He himself did not survive. And his perspective changes. His perspective changes. In the early years in the ghetto, 1940, he writes with a sense of optimism, a sense of cautious optimism. And as time goes on, he changes his tune. And he doesn't have the same kind of optimism. And these are two examples of this shift that took place within his writing, within his speaking. And obviously, as a community leader, he grappled with, how do I give people a sense of hope, but not at the same time give them a false sense of hope? So 1940, he's writing on the Parsha Vayeshev. Parsha Vayeshev, you have the story of Yosef's dreams. And in Yosef's dreams, he sees these sheaves of wheat. Those who remember the dream. And in Hebrew, the word is alumim. Me'almim alumim. They were gathering these sheaves, binding these sheaves. The word in Hebrew, me'almim, means sheaves, but it also comes from the word elaim, the root of the word alumim, aleph lamed mem, is also the word elaim, which means mute. So he talks about times, you can see in the English there, I'll read the Hebrew and you can follow with me in the English on the left side, I know it's very small and grainy, but do your best. A person sees a heaven forfend, a horrible situation, trouble that comes their way. So what they do is they try to strengthen themselves. You adapt to yourself, to the new situation. Until the situation passes. You say to yourself, right now, I'm incapable of speech. He's using the Parsha to reflect on what was going on with people who couldn't express what they were feeling. Crushing a person to such an extent. But even a person who's mute can communicate through gesturing, signaling, in a manner appropriate to his condition. So I too will speak a bit. I will sign from within my muteness. So that's what he says in maybe a circumstance that you can get through, and then you can move on to the better times after that. But when God forbid, Israel's troubles continue to increase so that each individual feels even more broken and crushed than a condition is reached where the state of Elaim, muteness, has become still more powerful, so that it is impossible to communicate even as a mute does. What happens then is that my sheaf, the Alumim, rose and stood erect, and that's what Yosef describes in his dream. At first I wanted to succumb and live a life of muteness, but when the muteness threatened to prevail, I could no longer bear it, so I took hold of myself, crying out to God more. And then, what does Yosef say? Your sheaves, your muteness turned around. That is, that you too found strength through me. And basically what he's saying is, you know, our life is supposed to be about connection to God, but now we're mute in that arena. Normally we're active and engaged, yet we're mute, we're crushed, and we're overwhelmed by distress. So when it comes to our connection to God, to our relationship, to our practices, we are super mute, completely destroyed by these circumstances. We can't even communicate through signaling or gesturing. So again, this is at the beginning of the war. You can only imagine how he's speaking as the years go on. And in the bottom piece, he talks on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av of 1942, that's the second piece, Parshat Matot, which is the summer months, the end of the book of Bamidbar. And over here, he recognizes, you know, what's going on, and he talks about Eicha, the book of Eicha, Lamentations. If anybody needs to read Lamentations in the middle of the Warsaw Ghetto. And he says that Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu, who wrote his own book, the book of Yirmiyahu, which is the prophet of destruction, that the temple was destroyed while he was the prophet for Israel, and he wrote the book of Eicha as well. And the Midrash says that he wrote the book of Eicha before the temple was destroyed. He actually wrote it before, because the book of Eicha is part of the prophets. It's a prophecy. And you can't give a prophecy if you're not in a joyous state of mind. So he knew that he wouldn't be able to write Eicha after the events of the destruction of the temple. He would only be able to write it before. This is because even to weep and lament with divine spirit is impossible without a bit of joy. So he's acknowledging, he's aware of what's going on, but he's talking from this perspective of brokenness. So, difficult words and difficult perspectives. It's almost like a diary, reading a person's diary of what he was going through. Then we get to Rav Ephraim Oshri in source number 7. Rav Ephraim Oshri, I mentioned before, was one of those who actually was able to escape. He ended up in the Kovna ghetto, but he did survive. And he, after the war, he actually wrote these questions and answers during the war. He had the luck, if you want to call it that, of being a caretaker, being appointed as a caretaker by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, in the ghetto to organize the books in the library. So he had access to a lot of Jewish books. And this is how he was able, in many cases, to answer people's very gruesome and horrible questions. I only brought 3 examples here. I'm not even going to read through them all. I only brought the questions, because the answers aren't really what's important. Questions give you just a shocking sense of the kinds of things that people were thinking about and were asking these rabbis. They were so worried about their spirituality, some of these individuals. And the first one on the right column, you have this situation where 2 days before the liquidation of the ghetto, there was a large group of people. And what they basically wanted to know, I'll just get to the point here at the bottom, whether he should commit suicide. There was a question about committing suicide, taking your own life, or allowing worse things, perhaps, to be done to you. That was one question. On the left side, you have a question of just unspeakable things that we're hearing here. You have a question here where there was a kinder action, specifically against young children, babies, who knows? And it was a question about parents, chas v'shalom, lo aleinu, saying Kaddish over their children. Should they say it? Should they not say it? What's the halachic practice? And in the third one, on the bottom left, you have another, each one just heart-wrenching. What's the proper phraseology of the bracha of Kiddush Hashem? when a Jew is giving their life, giving up their life, what's the, do you say Lakadish Hashem, or do you say Al Kiddush Hashem? And this is what was concerning them at this time, which in some people would call it spiritual resistance. Some people would call it just trying to search for some way of connecting, of figuring out a way to make sense, or to try to make sense of what was going on, to hold on to something. Three other examples, these are all from this time. First one is 1939, just before the war, a few months before the war broke out. And he was asked about, this was after 1938 Kristallnacht, I think 20,000, 30,000 Jews were sent to concentration camps from Germany. And many of them didn't come back. And the bodies were cremated, and they wanted to know, what do we do with the ashes of these bodies? In 1942, you have this decree prohibiting Jews from being outside after 6 p.m. This was in Hungary. It became difficult for women to perform the mikvah, to go to the mikvah on a Friday night. After that time, you can't be out, and that would mean that they wouldn't be able to go to the mikvah again for a few days. So would it be permitted to rely on a special permission that was written in a later book called the Chochmat Adam to immerse during the day hours of the seventh day, which generally isn't a permissible practice? And a third question, in the face of government decree requiring Jewish-owned shops to be opened on Shabbat, can the shops be left open, since the penalty for not doing so was the total shuttering of the stores by the government? And this is just a small selection of the horrific circumstances that Jews were placed in. And I leave them all as questions, because the answers are not even really what gives us a sense of what was happening and what was really important. It was the fact that people had these questions, that people were going through such horrors. You have here some really interesting documents in source 9 and 10. This is a Haggadah that was written by hand in France by Rabbi Kappel, who was the Rav in, I'm trying to remember what the name of the town was in France. This is in 1941. The Germans had already occupied France by that point. And you have here Lashana Hababi Rishalayim. You can see it in big letters. And then at the end of the final line of the Haggadah is in Yiddish. The Haggadah Solsain di Leitzen Galus. This Haggadah should be the last in exile, written in 1941. And in source 10, you have a picture of a prayer that was written by Rabbi Aaron Davids in Bergen-Belsen, 1944. And it's a prayer that he instructed Jews to say before they would eat chametz, because there was no matzah to be eaten in any of these places. And they say, "Hineni muchanim umuzumanim l'kayim mitzvacha." We want to do your mitzvah, but we're not able to do it in its full sense. Please be forgiving of us. So these are very, very heavy pieces, but they give us a little bit of a window in to the hope that people were trying to hang on to, and through the dignity that people were trying to die with. So we'll move into our last part here. And the last part is our generation, the post-Holocaust generation, trying to wrap our heads around these events, trying to wrap our heads around families that are no more, communities and cities that are no more. And Jewish leaders throughout the generations after the war grappled with this as well. And who am I to judge any of these comments? Some of them may anger you, some of them you may disagree with, but each was said, obviously, from a place of pain, from a place of trying to understand. And the first one here in Source 11 is from the Satmar Rebbe, Vayol Moshe, in his book. Vayol Moshe was the Rebbe, the rebuilder of Satmar Chassidut, the leader of the Eda Charedis in Yerushalayim for the 30 years after the Holocaust. He was born in Hungary. And when his father died, he moved to the town of Satmar, Satu Mare. For those who didn't know, Satmar was a combination of those words, Transylvania. In 1929, he became the rabbi of Satmar. After Hungary was overtaken by the Nazis, he was transferred to Klosenberg. He was in prison. He was in a ghetto, but he was saved. He got out on the Kastner train, for those who know the story. In 1945, he came to Israel. 1 year later, to the United States. You might have heard of some of these communities, Williamsburg, Kiryas Yoel, two very large communities of Satmar Hasidut. He was a virulent anti-Zionist. He did not have a lot of good things to say about Zionism, and he in fact believed, whether you call it a punishment or a result, Zionism was something that led to what happened in the years of the war of the Holocaust. And he writes that here in a few places in his book, in his introduction. You can see it for yourself here in source number 11. Very condemning words, secular Zionists. He was not the only one to advance this concept of mipnei chataenu, right, because of our sins. But it's not something that sits well with a lot of people to really think that the Jews could have done something as a collective that would lead to this. But it's important to hear the perspective. It's important to realize that it is a perspective, and whether you disagree, whether it angers you, and it angered many. Here's one example. Source 12, Rav David Halivni Weiss. He was born in a small town in Czechoslovakia at source 12 in 1927. He grew up in the home of his grandfather, who was a scholar in Romania. During the Holocaust at age 16, he was deported to Auschwitz. After a week, he was transferred to a forced labor camp, Gross Rosen, then to Wolfsburg, and then Mauthausen. He was in a number of camps, but he survived. He was the only member of his family to survive. He came to the United States when he was 18. He was in an orphanage. Eventually, he became educated and was a great lecturer. He was involved in JTS. And he wrote a lot about the Shoah and about faith after the Shoah. And here in source 12, he talks about his rejection of any attempt to try to justify it or try to explain what happened. Of the four things I have named, let me speak first of the one that I reject with derision, the attempt to make theological excuses for the Holocaust. I consider it obscene to assume the Shoah took place as a divine response to the spread of German culture, Haskalah, or secularism among Jews. First of all, these apologies are historically absurd. Germany had the most secular Jews, and yet more Jews of other nationalities were exterminated. And he goes on, I'm not going to belabor these pieces, you can read them for yourself. Rav Eliezer Berkovitz as well, theologian, thinker, who also wrote about this extensively, he has a different approach. He talks about the idea of Hester Panim, the hidden face of God. That God, where was God? It's not a question of where was God, it's a question of where was man. And that was echoed by many who looked at these statements of, how do we understand this? We have to look at free will. And he talks here about the fact that the minute that God decided to give free will to human beings, that was the minute that God had to hold back. Whenever something was going to take place that could alter history or that could create tremendous shockwaves in history. We'll just look at one or two lines here. First opening in 13. God cannot as a rule intervene whenever man's use of freedom displeases him. It's true, if he did so, the perpetration of evil would be rendered impossible, but so would the possibility for good disappear. Man can be frightened, but he cannot be bludgeoned into goodness. If God did not respect man's freedom to choose his course and personal responsibility, not only would the moral good and evil be abolished on the earth, but man himself would go with them. For freedom and responsibility are the very essence of man. I want to just read the last paragraph here, the end of that section. So he says at the end, the theology of a God unconvincingly present in history alone might not have sufficed. The dilemma cannot be resolved on the intellectual level alone. What he's talking here about is the fact that Jews throughout history have questioned and asked, where was God? Where is the righteous God? Where is the God of mercy? And indeed, neither Jeremiah nor Habakkuk nor even Eov, the ultimate question of why do bad things happen to good people, were given an intellectually valid answer. The Talmudic conclusion was correctly reached. God was silent. God was there. He talks about God empathizing. He has all these different pieces on this. Yet the dilemma was resolved, not in theory, but strangely enough, in history itself, that the Jews are still here. Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson as well talks about this idea in a number of places here at the bottom. And I want to conclude with a piece from Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel just passed away recently. And you have here on the last page an op-ed in the New York Times, which somebody sent me a number of months ago. I was preparing for a class. This is from 1997, and he wrote it, I think, before Yom Kippur. I believe it was right before Yom Kippur, and he wants to make up with God. So I want to read through it, and we'll just conclude with this piece. And it, in many ways, there's no way to wrap up a topic like this. There's no way to wrap our heads around a topic like this. But it will hopefully leave us with some sense of how we can reflect on this. So he writes, "Master of the Universe," and it's so fascinating that this is printed where it was printed and when it was printed. "Let us make up. It is time. How long can we go on being angry? More than 50 years have passed since the nightmare was lifted. Many things, good and less good, have since happened to those who survived it. They learned to build on ruins. Family life was created, children were born, friendships struck. They learned to have faith in their surroundings, even in their fellow men and women. Gratitude has replaced bitterness in their hearts. No one is as capable of thankfulness as they are. Thankful to anyone willing to hear their tales and become their ally in the battle against apathy and forgetfulness. For them, every moment is grace. Oh, they do not forgive the killers and their accomplices, nor should they. Nor should you, Master of the Universe. But they no longer look at every passerby with suspicion, nor do they see a dagger in every hand. Does this mean that the wounds in their souls have healed? They will never heal. As long as a spark of the flames of Auschwitz and Treblinka glows in their memory, so long will my joy be incomplete. What about my faith in you, Master of the Universe? I now realize I never lost it. Not even over there during the darkest hours of my life. I don't know if anybody here read the book Night. But in the book Night, Elie Wiesel has one of the horrific images is of a boy who was hanged in the camp that he witnessed. And he talks about how he feels like God was basically being destroyed at that moment. So he grappled with faith. And here he seems to be coming around in a different way. I don't know why I kept on whispering my daily prayers and those one reserves for the Sabbath and for the holidays, but I did recite them often with my father and on Rosh Hashanah Eve with hundreds of inmates at Auschwitz. Was it because the prayers remained a link to the vanished world of my childhood? But my faith was no longer pure. How could it be? It was filled with anguish rather than fervor, with perplexity more than piety. In the kingdom of eternal night and the days of awe, which are the days of judgment, my traditional prayers were directed to you as well as against you. Master of the Universe, what hurt me more, your absence or your silence? In my testimony, I've written harsh words, burning words about your role in our tragedy. I would not repeat them today, but I felt them then. I felt them in every cell of my being. Why did you allow, if not enable, the killer day after day, night after night, to torment, kill, and annihilate tens of thousands of Jewish children? Why were they abandoned by your creation? These thoughts were in no way destined to diminish the guilt of the guilty. Their established culpability is irrelevant to my problem. With you, Master of the Universe, in my childhood, I did not expect much from human beings, but I expected everything from you. Where were you, God of kindness, in Auschwitz? What was going on in heaven at Celestial Tribunal, while your children were marked for humiliation, isolation, and death, only because they were Jewish? These questions have haunted me for more than 5 decades. You have vocal defenders, you know. Many theological answers were given to me, such as, God is God. He alone knows what he's doing. One has no right to question him or his ways. Or, Auschwitz was a punishment for European Jewry's sins of assimilation or Zionism. And isn't Israel the solution? Without Auschwitz, there would have been no Israel. I reject all these answers. Auschwitz must and will forever remain a question mark only. It can be conceived neither with God nor without God. At one point, I began wondering whether I was not unfair with you. After all, Auschwitz was not something that came down ready-made from heaven. It was conceived by men, implemented by men, staffed by men, and their aim was to destroy not only us, but you as well. Ought we not to think of your pain, too? Watching your children suffer at the hands of your other children, haven't you also suffered? As we Jews now enter the high holidays again, preparing ourselves to pray for a year of peace and happiness for our people and all people, let us make up, Master of the Universe. In spite of everything that happened, yes, in spite, let us make up for the child in me. It is unbearable to be divorced from you so long.
Statement of faith.
Right? Amazing words. Not everybody has to have the same perspective as him. But I do believe that we have to look at the events of history with as open a mind and open eyes as possible. These are obviously very difficult points in history to look at and to delve into and to open up wounds that are connected to us and to our families and to our people. But I do think this juxtaposition that I started with, that we look at history and we don't understand how everything fits in and where everything fits in and how different points are part of some kind of plan, whatever question mark, not question mark, whichever approach works for someone in their head. I think that ultimately we have to step away and say, not Keli, Keli, Lama Azavtani, which was, why have you forsaken me, God? But Lema, as Rabbi Soloveitchik said, Lema is the question of, what are you doing now? What are you doing now? How are we rebuilding? How are we celebrating what we have today? The rebuilding of these communities, the rebuilding of these families. And for survivors, their revenge is their families. Their revenge is their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. And in so many ways, we have to look at our generation as, so how do we take what was lost and figure out how to move forward from it? So some of these thoughts hopefully can give us that inspiration. And as I said at the beginning, we were dedicating the words to the Kedoshim. All of their neshamot should have an aliyah.
But it hasn't stopped. It may have stopped.